Okay, I'm ready, but I'll wait a minute maybe. We have not many people here. So last class we last class we talked about some hand-wavy things about encryption, like confusion, diffusion, permutation substitution networks, and Feistel functions and all that stuff. We didn't get too much into detail of how these things work. We will get into more of that today. But not till next class, I will be doing the DES algorithm, which is more detail-oriented. So I'm going to start with now the word threat model is something that is used in many, many different places where you're talking about security, including cryptography or other parts of security, network security, system security. Threat model means what are you watching out for? The moment you come up with algorithms or approaches to solve a problem, what are the attacks that you can withstand and what can you not withstand? So that's part of threat modeling, and I will kind of talk about it from the crypto point of view in brief. In crypto threat model, we have attackers . Okay, what do attackers do? Get secrets. So in cryptography, we are essentially trying to keep things secret at the most basic level. There are other things, and these attackers are trying to get to your secrets. So if you have encrypted communication, they want the plain text of the communication. If you have some sort of authentication, they want to fool the authentication and say, I'm Alice, even though they're not. But how do they attack? They have a lot of power. This is a powerful adversary, not infinite power, but a lot of power. What does power mean? Basically, it means compute power. So if you're using an encryption algorithm to encrypt something, then they could be brute forcing it because they have that much power. But we talked about how brute forcing is not possible. If you had infinite power, you could brute force anything. But you don't have infinite power. So they're very powerful. That is, they have lots of computers, but brute forcing a good 64 or 128-bit algorithm will not happen. But you've got to watch out for what other things can be possible if you have enough computing power to attack the crypto protocol. And that's the threat model. Okay, I'm saying things that I've already said. All crypto algorithms must be open. That is under the Kirchhoff's principle, that it's completely published, because you want many eyes to look at it. People have trouble designing systems, etc., etc. If it's not open, Then we get into this thing called security through obscurity. And that's considered bad. Security through obscurity. Like, let's say email communications are insecure. We assume they are insecure. Sometimes they are reasonably secure, but we assume they're insecure. And there's millions and millions of email flying around all over the place. There's lots of spam. What happens if you send your credit card number over email? Probably nothing. Who'll notice that you sent a credit card number over email? Okay? But that is security through obscurity, that you believe that it's just flowing through this enormous amount of digital nonsense. Okay? But it's not security. You put it out in clear text, somebody else can get it. And in fact, it is very bad because they might be just searching for 16-digit numbers in your email, which would be a credit card number or whatever the number of digits in a number. So it is, but that obscurity can be defeated in many cases. Security through obscurity is something to watch out for. In any security solution, is it through some proper procedures, whatever they are, that is, the person can argue that this is properly done, attacker has to have so much power to break it, and that so much is infeasible, and it's not security through obscurity.
Since Kirchhoff wrote in 1808... Since Kirchhoff wrote so long ago, you know, for example, all the people trying to secure things during World War II, did that paper by Kirchhoff get lost until the 70s, or did people just say... No,
it wasn't an accepted, and it got lost probably, I don't know really, but he wrote something. Do we have to take that seriously? Well, or do we even know about it? But in the 70s, people go like, this is something that has a lot of meat to it. We really should follow this. Okay? So that's how it has become the law that modern cryptography follows and modern security systems should follow. Sidetracking a little, does every company that uses security tell you exactly how they are doing it? They don't. And that's a problem. They just say it's secure. Yeah, our bank is very secure. We take the best precautions. What are these precautions? What are you actually doing? They won't tell you. That is security through obscurity. This concept of you have to be open has not really flowed enough into the corporate world. It's getting more and more better, like password managers, some of them actually tell you how it works, and some of them don't. Only when they tell you or give you open source code or enough information that you know exactly how it's happening, that's when it's an open implementation. But it's not fully universal. It's universal in cryptography, but not necessarily in the software world. Did I do threat model? Oh, I missed something in the threat model thing. No. Yeah. Okay, adding to, since we are jumping between two topics which are interrelated, things have to be open. There is a threat model which says attackers have power, but hidden in that threat model is a bad assumption maybe, that secrets are kept secret. Okay, what's a secret? It's a nonce, it's a small number that is used as an encryption key or various other things. Challenge responses use secrets. There's a whole bunch of secrets out there. These secrets are kept secret. That is, they are not transmitted. So the idea is that we believe anything that is transmitted can be grabbed. But where do you keep the secret that you have to use? Can you like write it down on a piece of paper and store it in some locked thing? No, because you need the secret to run computations on that secret. You need the key to decrypt or encrypt. So it has to be on the memory of a computer that you are using to encrypt. Obvious. Can that secret be encrypted? No, because chicken and egg problem. How do you get the secret out of the encrypted secret? So you need the clear text secret to perform encryption. Now you're saying this secret, since it's never getting transmitted, will not be stolen. Can it not be stolen from the memory of a computer that you're using? The answer is yes, but we just assume that won't happen. Because when that happens, cryptography is useless. Because the plain text exists, the secrets exist on some computers. So the threat model says, we cannot guard against people stealing your computer memory. Okay? And that's the basic assumption, flawed, but we go from there. Okay, actual crypto functions, an encryption engine, a hashing engine, a pseudo-random number generator is a crypto algorithm. This is built out of building blocks. The building blocks we've already talked about, but let me write down the things. Exclusive OR, you know that. Shift, you have a register, you can shift the digits. It turns out to be useful in certain cases. So shifting is allowed, and you can circular shift, or you can push zeros into one end, or that end, left shift, right shift, all that is push. What happened? Permute. So you're just moving bits in a certain pattern. Now, I just chose to do it this way. It could have been done various different ways. If you've got a 4-bit input, you have a 4-factorial different ways of permuting it. Okay, and that would be used often. Permute can also be done by a table. That is, let's say if the input was 0000, the output is 0000, obviously. If the input was 0001, what will be the output? 1000. So you can build this table because you've already marked it out. So permutation can be table driven. Substitution is the same input. Okay, you're not permuting the bits. You're not substituting the bits. You're substituting the entire value. That means I build a table which says the input is 0000, the output will be 0101. I'm just making this up. It could be anything. Then if the input is 0001, the output is 1111. So it looks like there's no connection between the input and output, but there is. And it looks like that table is secret to know the connection. No, the table is not secret. The table is a fixed table used by this algorithm, published, but that is what the substitution step is. Okay? And that's how permutation substitution networks are built. Fixed permutations, fixed substitutions, they change depending upon bits of a key. So that means there's a lot of substitution tables, there are a lot of permutation tables depending on the key. Which one you use changes. Then there are four things. expansion permutation or expansion substitution or compression permutation or compression substitution can happen. Expansion means the input is maybe 4 bits, the output is larger than 4 bits. So if it's permutation, you permute these 4 bits into 6 and you fill up the other bits by repeating some other bits. So there's some repetition, some junk added to it. Compression means you have the larger one and the output is smaller. So if it's a permutation, you throw away some things and you keep the rest in a permuted fashion. So in case of substitution, you can do the same thing with tables where this column is larger than this or this column is smaller than this. So there'll be a loss or there'll be a repetition somewhere. Now that sounds completely useless, but it turns out it's not completely useless because of the ad hocness of algorithms. You do this and it works. Okay, there is more. I don't have space here. Maybe I do. This I will not explain. Just like these were just done on fixed-size bit patterns, you can do similar things on two-dimensional matrices. That's what AES uses. You have a two-dimensional matrix of bits, you have another two-dimensional matrix of keys, and you either XOR them or you use this one to substitute something. So it's not necessarily you have a one-dimensional, you can have two-dimensional things also. Of course, you can have three-dimensional, four-dimensional, but right now we are gone to two-dimensional in the AES algorithm. And most of the other algorithms are simply one-dimensional stuff. And so the idea is that all these tricks will lead to confusion and diffusion in some way. And this confusion and diffusion may lead to a good algorithm or a bad algorithm. Majority of the cases will lead to a bad algorithm. So how do you determine whether it's a good algorithm or bad algorithm? We have no idea. That's why you want it to be open. People will find problems with your algorithm. Okay? Now I'm going to go back and talk about a little bit of history and broken stuff. So it has always been realized that encryption is a one-way terminology is important. It's a one-way trapdoor function. One-way function. What's a one-way function? Are functions, can it be one-way or do it have to be two ways? Pardon? Reversible and irreversible. So addition is irreversible. Throwing away bits is irreversible. If you, simple things you can figure out. They're one-way functions and they're not one-way functions. So encryption cannot be a one-way function. It has to be reversible. But, so we say encryption is a one-way trapdoor function. The trapdoor means and that secret is the key. There's a secret way of reversing the function. You have to have that. And it's, although I've written it's a method, it's not a method, it's not an algorithm. The algorithm is not secret. But the secret in that algorithm is the key that will reverse the encryption function. Any other, if you don't have the secret, the encryption function has to be one way. But since it has a reversible thing, you cannot build an encryption function that's lossless, that's lossy. So whatever is the input, the encryption function output is one. You can never reverse it. It's absolutely one way, but it's useless. Okay? So it has to be reversible, and there's a secret to make it reversible. And if you can reverse it without the secret, that's a bad encryption function. So with that, okay, I'm sure all of you know the Caesar cipher.
I read in the textbook that you can use a one-way function for passwords.
Hash functions, yes.
Right, and so is that not cryptography?
No, one-way functions are cryptography. All hash functions are one-way functions. Now, the problem, okay, another little thing is that the existence of a one-way function or, yeah, one-way trapdoor functions, existence of these things have never been proven. We build them, we use them, but is it really a one-way trapdoor function? So that goes into math. Nobody's proven that such things exist, even though we have...
In the password case, you wouldn't need the trapdoor.
You never have to. Passwords are hashed, and you don't need to go back. You only look at it this way, so you don't need it.
We hear in the news all the time about people losing giant databases of passwords. It seems really simple that they could have used the one-way function.
They do use the one-way function, and we still know how to break it. Yeah, that's part of this class. The rainbow tables will crack one-way function passwords, but not in general. Only if it's passwords, alphabetical, this, that. If we know that, we can crack it. So Caesar cipher, supposedly 50 BC, what is it?
Substitution
cipher. Plain substitution cipher, that is A, B, you just use alphabets, and A will go to something. Let's say P. Then B will go to Q, C will go to R, etc. So there's a certain number of shifts, and it's circular. So it'll be PQR, whatever, then ABCD for the rest of it. Now, the good thing about this is it's very easy to do, it's very easy to decipher, but when you write English text transposed or substituted by the Caesar cipher, it becomes completely unreadable. And that was used, it seems, long time back. Why is it terribly weak? What is the key here? Is there a key? Of course, the encryption-decryption algorithms are obvious. You shift it this way to encrypt. You shift it the opposite way to decrypt. What's the key?
Number
of shifts. And how would you break Caesar cipher? Pardon? Yes. Well, there are two ways. Actually, 25. Okay. So this would be brute force. So even for a human, brute forcing Caesar cipher is not a big deal. Okay? You just do it 25 times, really. But remember, if you don't know, well, it's obvious to see, you must know what you're looking for. When you do it 26 or 25 times, you will get 26 or 25 different texts. Which one is the correct one? The one that makes sense, the one that doesn't look like gibberish. That is because we know it's a language, probably English, even if it's not English, some of them look like a language. So we know some property of the plain text. That's why we can do it. If it was plain gibberish data, you probably wouldn't know which one's the right one. Okay? So that part is hidden in any kind of brute force encryption algorithm. So one is brute force. Two is a technique that is useless to try on Caesar cipher because it takes more time than brute force, but it's tried on other ciphers. It's called letter frequency analysis. And you can guess what that is. Since Caesar cipher is... Okay, I'll throw in another word. Big long word which means monoalphabetic. Monoalphabetic, what does that mean in this case of Caesar cipher? You've encrypted a whole big paragraph of text. Now, monoalphabetic cipher like Caesar cipher is that every character of the input, if two characters in the input are the same letter, the output will be the same letter. So if A goes to E, every A will go to E. And that's a monoalphabetic, that is, it's table driven. And you, in a monoalphabetic cipher, you can do letter frequency analysis. That is, we already know if we have made an assumption it's English, E is the most common. So in the cipher, you find the most common one, and then you assume that's an E, and then you measure the shift between the input that produced this. So those will be E's, and you see the shift. So if the most common one is F, you know it's a one shift. So now one shift, the whole thing, you should get English. Maybe this is even better than... But no, here there's more counting involved, so it's a little bit more difficult than probably brute forcing it. One could argue whichever way. And what if in that particular paragraph E is not the most common, then you look for the second most common, etc., etc. So that's how you break Caesar cipher. Why am I even talking? It's obvious stuff. But it's like, okay, this is kind of the cat and mouse game, that you have a cipher, I'm going to try to break it. What are my bag of tools? Brute force, letter frequency, there's many, many myths. And it's monoalphabetic. So let's say monoalphabetic sounds bad. Now, following Caesar cipher, there's been lots and lots of similar, dissimilar, all kinds of ciphers. No point getting into all that. But one I will mention is called the Vinier cipher. The Vinier cipher says you need a table. Okay, so this is a fixed table used for constructing and deconstructing the Vinier cipher, and it's called the Vinier table. Your plain text is English, let's say, hello, how are you, or something, and your key would be a phrase or a set of characters. So let's say I choose my key as ABC. Okay? So that's my key, I've chosen it, and then I repeat it. Okay? So now I'm going to take, to produce the cipher, I take H and A, and I look up H over here, and this is the A. How do I do that? I forgot. But in this table, you put in H on this side and A on that side. Yeah, A, sorry. This is not H. Yeah, this is H. And this will be... So H and A will be H. And E and B... E and B will be whatever. C, D, F probably. There's an algorithm. I should have looked it up. But anyway, you do this. And you get the cipher, and you do it again, you'll get the plain text, as long as you're using the same phrase. The table is symmetric. But you can see trivially that it's not a monoalphabetic cipher. This H and this H probably will not become the same letter at the output, because the phrase is getting thrown in. So this is called a polyalphabetic cipher. And this was invented in 1467. Broken in 1863. So this polyalphabetic cipher called Vinier cipher seems to be very difficult to crack with larger passphrases and things like that. You just, without the passphrase, how would you break it? So it was a good design. It was considered to be a good design for like 400 years. No modern cipher has lived 400 years yet. Okay, so for 400, of course, there were no computers, so we didn't have very strong attacks, but for 400 years, this was considered to be an unbreakable cipher. It got broken in 1863 by a fellow called Kasiski. And it's a little bit of a detailed attack where you find common two-character or three-character patterns in the output and use that to do letter frequency analysis and things like that. You need a lot of ciphertext, but you can get the length of the phrase and then do something to find the phrase itself. And Wikipedia has an explanation of how the Kasiski attack works. Look that up for the finer details of the Kasiski attack. It's not important, but it's like, how do people figure out what's the technique here that was used by Kasiski to break Vinier cipher, which is a simple enough cipher to understand, but not simple to break. Okay, so these are cryptanalysis techniques, and something that Kasiski used to break Vinier will not be applicable to DES or something. So you've got to invent a break method to break a cipher. Okay? Then there has been another set of ciphers that are no good. Mathematical ciphers. That is, why all this permutation, substitution, mysterious stuff? Can we have a function where x is equal to ax plus b, where x is the plain text, a, b, actually n is the ciphertext. I'm sorry. I'll tell you what N is. So you pick a number n, which is your maximum block size, or what? Let's say n is 64, and so that many bits. And A and B are two numbers you pick. You encrypt a 64-bit x by performing this function modulo n and produce y. Now you can go on and on and on and do that. Okay? And that's the affine cipher. It has certain properties, but... So if given a bunch of cipher text, you cannot recover the plain text. It is a decent cipher. But it does not, it succumbs to a known plain text attack. That if you know the plain text and the cipher text, even a small quantity, you can find the key. So if somebody is encrypting using this, and sometimes you can guess what he's encrypting or what the plain text is, or it's revealed, you can find the rest of the plain text that you didn't get by just solving for A and B using a few pairs of X and Y. Actually, you need two pairs of X and Y, and you have two linear equations, you solve it. Done. So most math functions are reversible in some way or the other. But that's not a proof, it's that the affine cipher doesn't work. And of course you know that there is one cipher that is the best cipher ever, provably. Yes, which one?
One time pad.
So one-time pad is easy, you must have heard of it, but the interesting part is why do we call it the best cipher? It is what is it called? Oh, it's called unconditionally secure. There's no condition. The one-time pad is secure, always. What is the one-time pad? So we can do it using alphabets. We can do it using XOR. It just says the plain text. Okay, let's do it using binary. So plain text is a bit string, however long. The key is a bit string . You give it you take your plain text in binary, you generate a key that is random bits, zeros and ones, you flip a coin and keep generating the bits, and then you XOR the two, and you've got a ciphertext that cannot be reversed to the plain text, if you do not know the key. So the interesting part is, why am I making such a strong claim? It's a trivial... Of course, you know that if you have a key, cipher XOR key will be plain. Plain XOR key is cipher, and cipher XOR plain will give you the key. So if you know the cipher and the plain, you can easily derive the key. So what's so secure? Key and plain text have to be the same length. Pardon?
Key
will, of course, keep changing on any encryption. But the key for a particular case is a key, same length as the plane, and you cannot find this key if you don't have the plane. And if you have the plane, then you have the plane. And if you're part of the plane, you'll get part of the key, and that part of the key is useless for deciphering the rest of the ciphertext. Yeah.
The bits of the key are truly random.
The bits of the key has to be truly random. But let's say, how about brute forcing? Well, if it's a long thing, you can't brute force. Let's say I've got a short message, a 20-bit message. Can I brute force it? There's 2 to the power 20 keys. That's about not very much, 1 million. Even if it's a short message, you cannot brute force it. Why? Because brute force doesn't work for one-time pads. That's why it's unconditionally secure. Now, let's say my 40-bit thing is because I was encrypting English. So that'll be so many characters of English. Now I brute force it, and I throw away stuff that are not ASCII codes, and I get 40 bits will be how many characters? 8. Now 8 times 8 is 64.
Five
characters. Actually, it can be done more. So I get 5 characters. Of these 5 characters, if I generate all possible one-time pad keys, I will get all possible character strings, and some of them is gibberish, some of them are 5-character words. So every 5-character word in the English language will be generated. Now it's like, which one is the correct word? So there is no way of figuring out. Love and hate will both be generated in the brute force attack of a 4-character ciphertext. So did the thing say love or did it say hate? Now, will that not happen with any other cipher, like some cipher, and you encode the word love and you brute force it, will you get love and hate? The answer is no. And this is hard to see, that a cipher that we use does not have all possible keys. For short cases it might, but for longer cases it doesn't have all possible keys that of the same length. It has much smaller subset of encryptions and decryptions are possible. So ciphertext for love will very likely not translate to anything other than love. And that's why you know this is the correct one. Okay? And one-time pad is known to produce every possible plain text that can be produced of that length. Provided your keys are not repeated random numbers or something like that. Okay? So that's an unconditionally secure cipher. So great, we've solved the problem. Just use one-time pad. It has been used in World War II, but we don't use one-time pad. It's so simple. Why don't we use one-time pad? It's not a practical algorithm. So the rule is n-bit message has an n-bit key. This key cannot be reused. So that means that if you want to send somebody an n-bit message, you have to send them secretly an n-bit key. So if you can send them an n-bit key, why bother with encryption? You know a method to send them an n-bit key, which is the message. Okay? And it's not like I give you a key and any time I send you messages, use that key. No, you cannot repeat it. So I've got to send you a fresh key every time I send you a message. So that is completely useless. It has been used in a limited situation in World War II, etc., where it's called a one-time pad because the keys were written on pads and you throw away the paper when after you use it, and that's because they used to send the pads secretly by shape or whatever to the recipient and later transmit messages. They couldn't have sent the messages because the messages are not ready yet. So it's for future messaging. I'll pre-send you the pad and later whatever little short messages I'll have, you will just go and decipher it using that pad. And maybe there'll be some identifier as to which page to use. Okay? But, so if you can pre-arrange all this, then you can use it. So in modern cryptography, this is not possible. It's a one-time thing. And if you're not using one-time pads, then everything goes a little berserk. Because now we have to find crypto algorithms built out of XOR shift, permutation, substitution, etc., and hope that it works. Let's do 128. Another thing to note is that one-time pad will have 2 to the power n keys for brute forcing, and AES has 128, 2 to the power 128 keys, if you are assuming 128-bit. Moment n becomes larger than, say, 500, 600, this number is horribly smaller than this, which means if you're taking a 1 megabyte message and you're using 256-bit keys, at your ciphertext, you can have at most 2 to the power 256 different outputs, which is tiny part of the all possible outputs for a 1 megabyte message. So you're going to, when you brute force it, if you could brute force 2 to the power 128, the other way, you will get a very small part of the original possibilities. And that's why the parts that are really the correct answer is so unlikely for a not correct key that it doesn't happen. So an English phrase will only appear with one key, not the others. You've got to think about this a little. Whereas all possible English phrases of that length will appear with one time pad. Whole thing. So till now we've been kind of assuming that all ciphers are block ciphers. In the Caesar cipher, block is one character. In DES, AES, they are either 52-bit, 256 bits or 128 bits or 256 bits. A block of input passed through a block of key, and the key doesn't change, produces a block of cipher. These are block ciphers. Block ciphers are obviously are block ciphers monoalphabetic? Yes, because the same block with the same key will give you the same output. It's a fixed table of mapping from input to output. Is it built as a table? No, because we cannot store a 2 to the power 128 table. That needs more bits than there are atoms on Earth. So that's not going to happen. So we simulate through some method a 2 to the power 128 bit table, and we get a block cipher. And they are monoalphabetic. So monoalphabetic doesn't mean bad. Although we would like polyalphabetic, all our modern crypto algorithms are monoalphabetic. But they're not also. I'll get to that today. Then there is something called a stream cipher. Now, stream ciphers have always been a little nice. It's a cool way of doing things. It will be the best cipher, should be a stream cipher. But nothing, in the battle of ciphers, stream ciphers have lost it. The best one was RC4, and then it got, some people found problems with it. It's another Ronald Rivers cipher. And I think the whole stream cipher game has been abandoned, more or less. But it is still, RC4 is sometimes still used. Stream cipher works this way. You take a key and you feed it to a pseudo-random bit generator. You seed the bit generator with that key. Okay, we'll talk about how pseudo-random bit generators work. And it will produce a stream of bits, deterministic stream of bits, all random. Just XOR the input with the output. And it looks like a one-time pad. But it's not. Why is it not a one-time pad? It is pseudo-random because you need the pseudo-randomness because you have a small key. Small as in 128-bit key. Okay? If it was completely random, then you could not do it, repeat that same sequence again. How? And then it would become a one-time pad. So since this random sequence has to be repeatable, it has to come from a seed and a pseudo-random number generator. So what's the deal with a pseudo-random number generator that it's not truly random? That this is just like an ordinary crypto algorithm, and it's not a one-time pad. Out of a 128-bit key, you cannot generate 2 to the power 1 million different bit streams. You will only get 2 to the power 128. You will only get, depending on the key, 2 to the power 128 different bit streams. So their choice of using the input bit stream is limited to only 2 to the power 128 different ones for a 1 meg output. And that's a small part of the possible one-time bit keys, one-time pad keys. Okay? So the domain of the keys is much, much smaller. Yes, there may be repetitions also in the streams and things like that. That's too hard to see, but it's definitely polyalphabetic. It looks like a one-time pad, but it's not, and it's a cute idea. And the problem has been more or less this pseudorandom number generator generating that many outputs. Or somehow people don't like it. It's probably more of a political than a technological issue. Okay, so that's what a stream cipher is. RC4 is a good one, broken, but we'll look at RC4 details at some point in this class. Yeah.
If we're encrypting something that's not language, say an image, we have to do it as a stream cipher, right?
No. 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 You break it up into everything is a stream of bits, right. Whether it's a image or it's Excel spreadsheet, it's in a file, or it could be put in a file, it's a string of bits. When you get a stream of bits, you can break it up into blocks and feed it into an encryptor. Okay? So everything is one long string, but they're not. They can be broken up into pieces also. So everything's a number. Or a sequence of numbers, whichever way you... So if you have a block pseudo-random number generator that it generates numbers, you can just generate lots of numbers and convert it to a stream and you get a pseudo-random bit generator. They're all interchangeable. Okay, the modes is the important case here. Block cipher modes. Block ciphers are monoalphabetic ciphers. Today we use block ciphers, but we don't like monoalphabetic ciphers. So people have come up with ideas of converting block ciphers into polyalphabetic ciphers and by using something called modes. And there is a few popular modes, and whenever somebody is using an encryption algorithm, they'll tell you it's AES used in this mode. The mode have names like ECB, what are they? CBC. We'll do 4. CFC, CFM probably. Okay, I'm not sure. CBC is the most common use. ECB is electronic code book. So if you use a block cipher just the way it is, it's called ECB. That is, you don't mess with it. Why is it called electronic code book? We just said any block cipher is like a table lookup. So this table is your code book. You put in the input, you get the output. It's an electronic code book. Archaic term, but it's the word is heavily used. Use AES in ECB mode. That means you don't do anything. Just use AES and produce the output. It will be a monoalphabetic cipher. CBC is the most common way of running any block cipher. And the CBC, here. So the first block of the cipher works as follows. For the plain text, you XOR it with a well-known string called the initialization vector, or IV. There's nothing secret about this. It's a published, when you're using CBC mode, you tell everybody what your IV is, because that will be used to produce the final output. You run it through the encryptor, AES, let's say, with a particular key. All these sizes are the same, and you get your cipher. But that's only for the first block. The second block will be, so this is block one. Block two will be the next block of plain, XOR EC. And this key will be the same key. So this key is going... This is the same key. And instead of the initialization vector, you use this guy. So you XOR the next input with the ciphertext from the previous input, and you continue. And if you think twice, this is very easy to go backwards if you know the key. Because you can, from this cipher, you know this, you can get the plain text. You get this, and then you initialize. And then you generate the next one here, and you XOR it with that, and you'll get the plain. Now it's a polyalphabetic cipher. The same block of input, if B1 and B2 were the same, C1 and C2 will not be the same. Okay? Cute, very almost all encryption today is done in CBC. What else do I have? Okay, I have the cipher feedback mode, CFB. CFB is cipher feedback. There is an output feedback. I won't do that. Pardon? Yeah. Okay, last block is never the same size, but in encryption, all blocks have to be the same size. Okay, if the last block is not the same size, you pad it. With what? there are, in the documentation of the encryption, they'll tell you what's the padding. And there are various different kinds of padding, and you pad it. Let's say you pad it with all zeros. And then how do you know that's part of the input or not? I mean, part of the when you decrypt, you'll get a bunch of zeros at the end. Maybe the data contained zeros. So then at some point, you also transmit the size so that you can truncate to the correct size. Okay? And then there is something called MACs, message authentication codes, which will tell you whether you got the right output. So I'm just covering one small part here. So there's more. Okay, so we'll do the cipher feedback. IV is initialization vector. Now, this is very cute, but it's like, okay, isn't this a stream cipher? It is. You take for the first block an initialization vector that's well known, and you get this thing, which is nonsense. Because an attacker cannot get this because he doesn't know the key. So then this thing is XORed with the plain text to get cipher. Then you take this junk, put it as the initialization to an encryptor, and you get this, which is XORed with the plain text. Which means that essentially this is if you take all the bits here, tack it on to all the bits here, tack it on to all the bits here, they are just random bits. And then you're XORing with the plain text, you've got a stream cipher on your hands. So you can convert a block cipher into a stream cipher. That's a random number generator right there. That random number generator is seeded with this key. The initialization vector is irrelevant. You need to know what it is, but it's published information. So how do you build a random number generator? You can build it this way. Do you see anything wrong with it? Yes, but this is never exposed. And the key is unknown. So you cannot reconstruct any of this unless if you know the key. And if you know the key, it's trivial to reconstruct that sequence. XOR it with the ciphertext, you'll get plain text.
What if the function key is idempotent, so it gives out the same thing every time?
The key is idempotent, yes.
Function
E is an encryptor. E is an encryptor. For different input, it will produce different outputs. And if it's, let's say, E is the, what is it called, is a pass-through, that it produces the same as the output. Then it will be a bad encryption, but it will work. It will, it'll ignore the key. So the plain text will be XORed with the IV at all stages. But since you are using an encryptor, this encryption will be as strong as the encryptor E. So if you are using AES to do this, it will be as good as AES. Okay, so once you have an encryptor, you can use ECB, that's the simplest. Or you can do the cipher block chaining, or you can do the cipher feedback, which looks bizarre, but it all boils down to the same thing. You're producing from some input a jumble of bits and you're using it to construct ciphertext. And you're preserving all the information of the plain text in the ciphertext. No bit is getting lost. It's not reversible. We think it's not reversible, but it's not reversible because we think it's not reversible. Except when you know the key, it's easy to reverse it. Okay? And the counter mode is just for the sake of it. treat the key as a counter, keep incrementing it. And you got a polyalphabetic. So the key changes, but it changes very... And, okay, plus one, plus two, whatever you choose. No, it'll never overflow. If it does, you go back. So these are ideas. See, there's a flexibility. Once you have a crypto algorithm, you can play all kinds of games with it. You can build random number generators, you can build hash functions, you can use it in this mode, that mode. The secret is, what is this E? The E is the big problem. Okay, any questions? Since I have a bit of time, I'll talk about RSA first. Any questions? Unless I'm going to change topic a little. Yeah. Yeah. And loss less. Throwing away bits will make it not reversible. There is compression which is lossy, but it let's look at DES, you'll figure out. I mean, no, you cannot lose information. You can throw away some bits here which was derived from some expansion somewhere. End result is, if you have n bit encryption, 2 to the power n different inputs are possible. For each input, 2 to the power n different outputs are possible, because there are 2 to the power n different keys. And two inputs cannot produce the same output, because then it will be lossy. So it's a mapping, a table from distinct inputs to distinct outputs, and there are 2 to the power n such tables, one table per key. And that's the problem of designing a good cipher. Okay, it is a challenge. But XORing with a 2 to the power n bit key will work. It'll satisfy all the conditions I've just said. So my next topic is DES. I'll cover it later, next class. Do I have time for RSA? I kind of have time for RSA. I've given you the basic idea of an asymmetric cipher. There's K1 for encryption, K2 for decryption. K1 and K2 are seriously married, but you can't find K1 from K2, or you can't find K2 from K1. It's a mystery. So how does RSA work? I'm trying to generate K1 and K2. So to do that, I choose randomly 2 very large prime numbers less than a certain value I've chosen. Then I say, I will pick a value n which is equal to p times q. I will pick a value called phi n, which is p minus 1 times q minus 1. That's something I made up. Okay? Then I will pick e, I have a whole, E has to be co-prime with phi n, blah, 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 doesn't matter. Everybody picks 6, 5, 3, 3, 7. That's the industry standard for encryption key. All RSA algorithms implemented in real life uses this number, 6, 5, 5, 3, 7. It's 2 to the power 16 minus 1. It's got some property. But the property that RSA needs is this number must be co-prime, which is relatively prime to this number. And this is almost guaranteed to be relatively prime, unless if this number is a multiple of this, which doesn't happen. And it's a prime number. No, that's not true. Okay, so I know I've got P and Q. From P and Q, I know N. From P and Q, I know phi N. I pick a number E. I will look for a number D such that E times D modulo N, modulo phi N will be 1. And there's an algorithm to do that. Okay? Chinese remainder theorem. Once I'm done, I'm left with P, Q, phi N, N, E, D. That's all the numbers I have. Right? Very important step. Get rid of those numbers. So now that we have got rid of these, we have N, E, D. E and N is my public key. E and D is my private key. E and D and E. Encryption. P is my plain text. I take it to the power E modulo N equals cipher. And C, so this is decrypt to the power D modulo N is equal to P. That's how it works. So I've got three numbers here. N is the modulus, so that I tell everybody. And E is 65537, everybody knows. If somebody encrypts something with this public key, he should be taking the plain text, a block of plain text, raise it to the power E, and modulus of N. That's my cipher. And the cipher, if you just raise it to the power D, modulo N, you will get back the same plain text. That's not obvious. It's possible to show why, which will need a lot of math. I think we are going to do that, and that's how RSA works. And so, once you have this, you know this, you know this, you can never find this. You need phi n to find that. Phi n is p minus 1 times q minus 1. So you need p and q. Finding p and q should be easy. You know n, p times q is n. Can't do that. That's why once you have the public key, you cannot find the private key. Their roots are lost. And that's the mystery of RSA. Okay?